Now we go overseas. You are listening to a podcast from the Historical Society Listeria, Bremen, Germany, in cooperation with volunteers in the United States. Act 6. Welcome or not welcome? A fearful question. How the conditions of immigration to the United States have changed since the early 20th century. Yes, they are coming, the tired, the poor, the huddled masses who long to breathe free. Are the wretched ones rejected on the besieged shores of North America? Will they, the homeless people driven by the storm, be sent back to Europe like the 937 passengers on the Hapag ship, St. Louis? Jewish refugees like Siegfried Frank from Niederohmen, whom the Nazis would then murder in Auschwitz? Lady Liberty holds her lamp high next to the golden door, but immigration policy will be tightened over the next few decades.
In 1911, the Dillingham Commission publishes its report on the social impact of immigration. It has concluded that those who immigrated to the United States after 1890 pose a danger to the society in the United States and distinguishes in between old and new immigration.
In 1917, the first reading and writing tests are held for those wishing to enter the country.
In 1921, the Immigration Act limits annual immigration to 350,000 people and introduces quotas for nationalities.
In 1924, annual immigration was limited to 165,000 people.
In 1927, there are only 150,000. The quota for nationalities will also be redefined. The number of immigrants in a nation may be 2% of the number of its compatriots from the 1920 census. This law remains in force until 1965 and above all reduces the number of immigrants from Africa and Asia.
In 1929, during the Great Depression, a new quota is set. 70% of the 150,000 people who are allowed to immigrate have to be from Northern and Western Europe, the rest from Southern and Eastern Europe.
Thank you.
In 1933, only 23,068 people are allowed to immigrate. After the Nazis come to power, there's a run on the U.S. consulates, but only a few visas are issued.
In April 1934, Norbert Goldenberg, born in Kestrich, Upper Hesse, emigrates to the U.S. Because of Nazi laws, he has lost his job as an assistant at the University Clinic for Internal Medicine of Frankfurt, Main, and his approbation as a physician. Almost right away, he is appointed as vice president of the German Jewish Club and the Aufbau, a German Jewish newspaper. 3 decades later, he will be its president and publisher. At the Aufbau, he meets his future wife, Lilo Lamm, a refugee from Berlin, daughter of Leopold Lamm from Homberg, Ulm. She is working as a secretary and will write essays about her family all her life. As soon as possible, Norbert Goldenberg works as a physician again. In 1936, he passes his American medical examination and works in a hospital before opening an office and private practice in Washington Heights, Frankfurt on the Hudson, a home away from home for many German emigrants. Da kennst du mich hin, aus der Arme, aus dem Sinn. Ich kenn mich nicht, ich komm dich hin, wo ging mir's du dann hin? Sag,
tell me, do you know me or don't you? Out of sight, out of mind? This was an Upper Hessian version of Auld Lang Syne, an audio from a singing workshop in the former synagogue of Oberglien in
1937, the 11-year-old Kurt Wilhelm Freund from Nuremberg and his parents crossed the Atlantic. His mother, Paula Grünstein, Freund from Miltenberg, has a knowledge that will help the family to survive. She has bribed a baker at the famous Haberlein Metzger Lebkuchen Manufactory to give her the secret recipe. During World War II, she bakes and sells Paula's celebrated Lebkuchen. There are advertisings in the Aufbau, and the New York Herald Tribune publishes about her Nuremberg Elisen Lebkuchen startup in December 1939. Germany ousted Paula, so she mastered the baker's art. And she is quoted, "Nazis couldn't stop anyone from taking something away in the head." William Kurt Freund, as her son calls himself, after getting American citizenship, becomes chief economist of the New York Stock Exchange and marries the photographer Irmgard Judith Steinberger, born in Alsfeld in 1920. Her family had fled to Haifa in August 1933, and she came to the United States after the war. Daughter Nancy is married to Jeffrey Heller, a human rights activist, writer and lawyer specialized in immigration law. He has dedicated his life to combating prejudice and raising awareness about refugees and migrants in the United States, as can be read on the website of Human Rights First.
Dina Gardner, née Nussbaum, from Almbach, has emigrated to the United States with her sister Regina before the First World War. In 1939, the widow vouched for the family of her niece Hannah. Like many other patriotic German Jews, the Sterns had hesitated to leave their hometown, their homeland, and Europe. After the pogrom night of November 1938, the so-called Kristallnacht, followed by the internment of 10,000 of Jewish men in concentration camps like Dachau and Buchenwald, it becomes crystal clear that Jews are in danger when Nazis are in power, and that the only rescue is to leave the country or, better, the continent. Like many Jews who fled from Eastern Europe after the pogroms in the late 19th century, Joseph and Hannah Stern from Niederohmen in Upper Hesse disembark from the Deutschland in New York with their five-year-old daughter. Ruth Stern Gaston has written about this in her childhood autobiography, An Accidental American.
So, you're headed for Chicago, eh?
My mother heard Chicago and nodded, even though she had no idea what he said. After we were finished with him, we saw the doctor to make sure that we didn't have any serious illnesses. We didn't. And then we were outside, where thousands of eager faces scanned each of us, looking for their relatives. I don't know how my Uncle Albert found us, but he did.
Willkommen in Amerika, Josef, Hannah, und Rutchen.
Someone was speaking to us in German. We turned around, and there he was, a short, round, balding man wearing a striped suit. Albert Stern, Daddy's youngest brother. Uncle Albert was an accountant who had been in New York for about 10 years and knew his way around. He quickly hailed one of the many waiting taxis.
Family Sondheim from Oberglin in Upper Hesse also fled to the United States. In 1939, Siegmund and Jette Sondheim, their children Adi, Herbert, and Rita, and Siegmund's sister, Bertha, went on board a ship. Robin Smolin, née Sondheim, who belongs to the first generation in New York, tells the story of her family.
In 1939, my father, Herbert Sondheim, Daddy, was not yet 12 years old when he and his immediate family fled Germany and Hitler's persecution of the Jews. They had to leave their home in Oberglin and most of their possessions behind to escape to the safety of America. Upon arrival at Ellis Island, they settled in Washington Heights, a neighborhood in New York City with a big German Jewish community. Daddy had many relatives already living there who had previously arrived in New York from Germany. They lived with aunts and uncles at first before renting their own apartment. It was nice having family there since Daddy and his parents and siblings spoke no English and had to start over again in this new country. Everyone lived near each other, went to synagogue together, took walks together, and met for cake and coffee in the evenings. Family, friends, and socializing was important to them in Germany and continued to be even more so in New York. In New York City, my grandfather became a merchant while my grandmother worked in a millinery factory making women's hats. My Aunt Addie, who was older, worked in an office, and Daddy and his little sister Rita went to school. Daddy spoke no English and had to learn quickly to catch up. He was determined and became an excellent student.
Like many men of German descent or migrants born in Germany, Herbert Sondheim served in the U.S. Army.
When Daddy turned 18 in 1945, he was drafted into the Army. Feeling very grateful to be given the opportunity to start a new life in the U.S., Daddy proudly served his new country. He was a topographical surveyor, creating maps for the Army. He served with honor and pride. When he was 19, his father died, and he was honorably discharged to go home and support his family. Daddy worked full-time during the day to support his family and attended college full-time at night. He graduated with a degree in accounting. While in college, Daddy began working at an international shipping company. Daddy started as a bookkeeper, worked his way up to accountant, treasurer, and was then offered ownership of the company, which he accepted. He had a most exciting experience, owning large freight vessels, acting as agent for shippers, and dealing with many governments, learning the ins and outs of the shipping business, and traveling all over the world. He became well-known and highly respected in the industry, and also acted as a lead arbitrator for the Maritime Society.
He was a family man by then, as he had married at a young age and founded a family. It was love at first sight.
Daddy met my mom, Beatrice, or Beatie, or Bee as he called her, and the love of his life, at a dance in Manhattan when he was 23. He saw a beautiful blonde come out of the restroom with her girlfriends and bet his friends that he would get her to dance with him. She did, and they were married in 1952. They rented an apartment in Washington Heights near his mother and made a happy life there. My two sisters were born shortly after, and my parents decided it was time to buy a house in the suburbs. They bought a house in 1960, and 4 years later, I was born. Daddy and Mom raised us with love and pride, instilling the values important to them. My sisters and I had a happy childhood filled with love and laughter and fun and adventures.
Back in the 70s, Herbert Sondheim had explained German proverbs and even a joke on anti-Semites to one of his sons-in-law. The recording has stood the test of time. In the background, his wife, Beatrice Sondheim, and one or two children are to be heard. To get the joke with the policeman, one has to keep in mind that many Jews are circumcised and that men did not wear their watch around their wrist.
And so it was. Back in Germany, in 1935, a policeman in Frankfurt on the train, a station on the platform, said to a fellow, "Hey, Jew, what time is it?" And the Jew turned around and answered, "Now that you could look through my pants, you can also look through my vest pocket."
Who was it in German?
Which said, "Jude, who is this? Du hast mir durch die Hose geguckt, jetzt schau mir durch die Westtasche."
And he goes on.
"Der Apfel fällt nicht weit vom Baum." Means the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. "If the egg is smarter than the chicken, that doesn't do any good."
In German.
"Und das Ei gescheiter ist wie ein Huhn, das tut kein Gut." A thought that just came to mind is, "Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, käme ich in Verlegenheit." If I could translate it into this, if I could wish myself something, I would be embarrassed, because I have everything and I can't think of anything that I could wish for myself.
The original, one of Marlene Dietrich's songs, goes like this: "What I should wish for, a good or a bad time." And then Herbert Sondheim recalled his childhood.
A little saying for children on someone's birthday, little children particularly, that reminds me of my youth. We used to either bring a flower or something, and then we would stand and say, "Ich bin klein, mein Wunsch ist klein, Mama, du sollst glücklich sein." Translated, "I am small, my wish is small, Mother, you should be happy." Anyhow, it rhymes. Many of the German little sayings are always in form of rhymes. So that's where the mainstay of their culture left them.
Obviously, he no longer identifies with the Germans, but this doesn't keep him from making fun of those who were born in the United States.
Mom comes in and says she can't close the garage door. So I go out, and 1, 2, 3 is a very simple procedure. Then I tell David, die Eingeborenen sagen, sie sind Affen. So das ist nicht zu tun, bro. Translated means the natives say they are monkeys, so they don't have to do any work. That applies here too. Till next time.
It is audible that Herbert Sondheim enjoys speaking his mother's and father's tongue, German with a Hessian accent, and also some words of Yiddish.
On the departure of guests, it is commonly said that by the größte Simcha sind die Gäste nicht da. In other words, after they left, that's the biggest Simcha. The equivalent to that is everybody brings joy. Some when they come, some when they go. I say mostly when they go. So much for that.
In 2015, Herbert Sondheim died. Robin Smolin shares a loving memory.
Daddy was a special person. He was a loving son who respected and cared for his parents. He was a loving brother who on occasion created some mischief. He collected postage stamps, liked doing jigsaw puzzles, and loved potatoes, although sometimes he was not allowed to eat them because he ate too many. He was a devoted husband and father and always provided for his family. He had 3 daughters, 6 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. Yet later in life, he was referred to as Grandpa by hundreds of people. Every time he met a friend of one of his children or grandchildren, they instantly felt a warm, familiar connection with him. He had a wonderful sense of humor and a twinkle in his eye and a natural way of making everyone feel at ease. He was a great storyteller and had many stories to tell about his exciting life and world travels. Daddy had a full and enriched life. The importance to him of family, religion, hard work, integrity, humor, and enthusiasm for life left a great legacy.
Many Germans ate what tasted like home. The potatoes Herbert Sondheim from Upper Hesse loved too much were also served frequently in the family of klezmer artist Yael Strom, who was born in Detroit and has ancestors in Germany as well as in Eastern Europe. He lives and teaches in San Diego. Together with his wife, the klezmer singer Elizabeth Schwartz from New York, he often tours through Europe. In the old synagogue of Obergleen, he has given a concert in 2017 with guitar player Nikolai Mook from Frankfurt, Maine. Yael Strom is not only a great violinist, but also a charismatic entertainer who introduces his audience to authentic Jewish culture, language, and traditions, as in the potato, pardon, Bulba's song. He learns it over the table, he says, from his grandma, who was from Ukraine. The German word for potato is Kartoffel.
Mr. Bill Knapp is vegan Kartoffel. This is a lead, Kartoffel auf Deutsch, auch Yiddish, aber wir sagen euch in Yiddish Kartoffel Bulbis. Bulbis is the ukrainische Wort. Bulbis. Und ich habe gelernt das nicht von den Archiven, nicht von Wanderen und Reisen. Ich habe gelernt über den Tisch von meinem Baba, von meiner Großmutter.
Thank you.
Zitika Bubis, a Montika Bubis, a Dean Stickle Meat Voka Bubis, a Domestic and Friday Bubis, Shabbos in an oven a Bubis, Kigala, a Ziti, a Viter Bubis, Hippo, a Hey!
One of Herbert Sondheim's six grandchildren, Henry Smolin, has a high reputation in music. Henry Smolin, the son of Robert and Stuart Smolin, had started to play piano at the age of three in 2001 and gave his first public performance in San Jose, California, when he was 5 years old. A veteran of the concert stage, he has performed all over the United States, making his orchestral debut at 8 years old with the El Camino Youth Symphony in Palo Alto, California. His performances include recitals at Carnegie Hall in New York, the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia, the Monterey Next Generation Jazz Festival, and at many well-known festivals. Henry Smolin was admitted to the San Francisco Conservatory of Music when he was 8 years old and has received a Master of Music degree in piano performance at the Juilliard School in New York City. The piece he is playing at the end of this podcast is the fourth movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 3, Opus 2. The sonata, often referred to as Beethoven's first virtuosic piano sonata, was composed in 1795 and was dedicated to Joseph Haydn.
In 1939, when family Sondheim has arrived in the United States, 83% of all Americans were opposed to taking in more Jewish refugees. Senator Robert Wagner and Representative Edith Rogers form a rescue committee and try to bring 20,000 orphans to the United States with a bill, but the children are included in the quotas. Unlike other countries, there is no kinder transport to the United States. Jewish Germans are suspected of being spies, and some influential anti-Semites in business circles, the State Department and other institutions are preventing the United States from becoming a haven.
In 1940, President Roosevelt arranges for 3,268 well-known people from science and art to receive special visas. Journalist Varian Fry goes to Marseille on behalf of Eleanor Roosevelt's Emergency Rescue Committee to rescue Jews.
In 1941, the United States entered World War II after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941.
In 1942, migrant workers from Mexico are needed. The legal basis for this is being created.
In 1943, restrictions on immigration for Chinese are lifted. Anyone who comes from an enemy country has little chance of being accepted. The application form for a visa is almost 5 feet long and must be completed on both sides. Two guarantors are needed, each of whom must also provide two guarantors. Anyone who comes from Italy or the Third Reich and has not yet been naturalized is considered an enemy alien and must carry a pink identity card. The assets are frozen. Radios, cameras, and weapons have to be handed over to the authorities, and it is not uncommon for children to be separated from their parents.
From 1933 to 1945, 107,832 people emigrated from Germany and Austria to the United States.
In 1948, the Displaced Persons Act is passed, the first law in the United States specifically for refugees. 400,000 people uprooted during the Second World War are allowed to enter the country. Among them were the sisters Hilda and Carola Stern from Niederohmen, who had survived Auschwitz and had been in a DP camp in Austria, as well as Bea Karp, née Stern from Lauterbach in Upper Hesse. All of them orphans since their parents had perished in the Holocaust. Beate Stern and her little sister Susie had been hidden by the Jewish Children's Rescue Organization, OSE, in France. The book My Broken Doll that she published together with her daughter Deborah Pappenheimer is her legacy. In the U.S., Hilda Stern Cohen saw her much younger cousin Ruth Stern, her aunt and uncle from Niederohmen, and other relatives again. She moved to Baltimore, where so many other Upper Hessians had settled since the 19th century, when the port of Baltimore was the second largest gateway to the U.S., one of the destinations for steamships from Bremen. 21-year-old Hilda Stern went on board in Bremerhaven in 1946. In Baltimore, Hilda married Werner Cohen, a survivor from Essen. They raised three daughters and got 12 grandchildren. Hilda worked as an educator and bore testimony, but only after her death in 1997, her husband found her Holocaust poems that she had written after the war. They were published later in Germany under the title Genagelt ist meine Zunge, Nailed is my tongue, and in the book Words That Burn in Me, Faith, Values, Survival, that came out in 2008. Powerful poems full of pain and loss and hope, like the one titled Heimat, a word that means so much more to a German immigrant than fatherland, home or home country.
Heimat. Überall ist meine Heimat, überall mein rastlos Herz, überall sind meine Träume, überall mit mir der Schmerz. Überall kommen Nächte täglich gleich auf mich herab, überall ist eine Sehnsucht, überall find ich ein Grab. Home. Everywhere is my home, everywhere my restless heart, everywhere are my dreams, everywhere the pains with me, everywhere nights come down on me day by day, Everywhere is a longing. Everywhere I find a grave.
Storyteller Gail Rosen from Baltimore, who had made interviews with Hilda, followed her traces in the documentary film For Tomorrow, Ich Hoffe auf Morgen, in 2010, directed by Eve Renabard, produced in Europe and the US.
In 1950, in the midst of the Cold War, communists were denied immigration under the Internal Security Act. Over the next two decades, 790,000 people will emigrate from Germany to the United States.
This Upper Hessian cover song of Scarborough Fair is about the path of life, about belonging together, at least for a while, and about mourning. Those who are left behind have perished.
In 1951, 36-year-old Ellen Knauf, née Raphael, is finally allowed to take the ferry and to leave Ellis Island for good. For 3 long years, she had been held on the island that had been, during World War II, turned into a camp for U.S. citizens of German, Austrian, Japanese, or Italian descent. The Supreme Court had ruled against Ellen Knauf. Her deportation had been stopped at the last minute. Several times the international press had reported about the struggle of this former civil servant of the U.S. Army, and Ellen Knauf has published her memories. In 2020, Time magazine had written about her famous case under the headline, A Dark Side of Ellis Island's History. In her young life, Ellen Knauf had already changed the country 4 times and her citizenship 2 times when she came to the U.S. In 1934, at the age of 19, she had married a Czech and had moved to Czechoslovakia. When the war started in 1939, she fled to England. For years, she worked for the Royal Air Force and after the war for the U.S. Army in Frankfurt upon Main. In 1948, she married a U.S. citizen in Frankfurt. Her husband, Kurt Knauf, a German by birth, is a veteran working for the administration of the U.S. Army in Germany. Soon after the wedding, Ellen Knauf tries to emigrate to the U.S., following the invitation from the War Brides Act. But when she arrives on Ellis Island, she is declared a risk for national security, and without any further explanations, access to the U.S. is denied. It is a shock, but Ellen Knauf is willing to fight. Finally, she succeeds in getting an audition and learns that she has been taken for a communist spy. It takes her a long time to prove that she is innocent. One of the crucial questions in her case: is anyone who is not an American citizen and hasn't formally entered the country entitled to be protected by the Constitution of the United States of America?
In
In 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act was passed. The category race must no longer be an exclusion criterion. At the same time, an ideological criterion is introduced, because we are in the era of political witch hunt. Anyone who wants to enter or immigrate to the United States may be turned away because of political views.
In 1954, Ellis Island is closed. The last of the approximately 12 million people who have passed through this station is the Norwegian Arne Petersen, a 48-year-old sailor who has once again stayed longer than allowed in the United States and has therefore been interned. Arne Petersen was deported a year later. He died in 1981 in his hometown of Larvik in southern Norway.
In 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act is amended. National quotas will be abolished. In 1980, the Refugee Act comes into force. Those who want to flee from a country behind the Iron Curtain or from the Middle East are no longer given preferential treatment.
During the Reagan era, the Immigration and Control Act comes into force. Illegals living in the U.S. since 1982 are covered by an amnesty. At the same time, employers who employ illegal workers are threatened with sanctions. Border controls on the border with Mexico will be tightened.
In 1990, immigration quotas will be extended.
In 1995, immigration will be limited to 675,000 per year, the majority 480,000 in the context of family reunification, 140,000 job seekers, and 55,000 from countries from which few immigrants have been recorded so far.
Ellis Island has been a museum for decades. The Statue of Liberty is a World Heritage Site.
According to the 2020 census, together the English 46.6 million, German 45 million, and Irish 38.6 million alone, or in any combination populations, made up over half of the white alone or in combination population of the U.S. About 12% of the U.S. citizens have roots in Germany. How the United States immigration system works is described in 2024 on the website of the American Immigration Council.
Among the Hessian refugees in the Nazi era who have written childhood memoirs is Paul Kiste, aka Kleinstrasse, from Wiesbaden, as well as Ruth Stern Glass Ernest from Dietz upon Lahn, who fled together with her mother, Johanna Stern Ney Lam, from Obergleen, her father, Louis Stern, from Bald Uenstein, her brothers, Hermann and Ernst Lothar. They had to start anew from almost zero, and in like many other immigrant families, the parents saw to it that their children got a good education. Hermann and Ruth went first to a nearby public school. The almost 15-year-old Hermann into grade 7 and Ruth into grade 1 instead of grade 5. A placement strategy to teach immigrant children English, she wrote in her memoir. Ruth learned the meaning of the sight words on flashcards, which taught her classmates to read. The first names were anglicized, but the parents still spoke some German and Yiddish. Hermann joined the U.S. Army and later the American military government in Germany to help restart industry in what his family called the Alte Heimat, the old homeland, under the Marshall Plan. After his return, he had a responsible position at General Electric. Ruth worked for decades as a teacher in New York and died in 2012. Her memoir, The Gate, that she has dedicated to her second husband, to her two sons, Abraham and David Glass, to her daughter-in-law, Amy, and her granddaughters, Molly and Madeline, has been translated into German. In 2016, 2 years before his death, her little brother, Ernst Lothar, called Ernie, recounted his amazing career.
I was educated here in the United States. I was only almost four when we came here, went to public schools, graduated from high school, went to a very good university called Cornell, where I received a Bachelor of Science degree in economics, and worked in the electronics field all my working career. The job that I held longest and until I retired was with the French electronics and defense contractor, then called Thomson CSF, currently called Thales, large corporation. I was the first American they hired. I lived in New York City in Manhattan. Our offices were in Manhattan at first, and then eventually we began buying some companies in the United States. I became chief executive officer of the company, worked with them for 41 years, and retired in 2002.
While reasons for global migration are not diminishing in the face of wars, climate change, famine, extreme poverty, oppression and persecution on political, cultural, racist, sexist, and religious grounds, immigration becomes one of the main topics in political debates in the US as well as in Europe and other countries. More and more restrictions are demanded by extreme right wings, but also by conservative parties. And if there is not a wall erected, populists call for the closing and control of once open borders, rejection, internment, and deportation. Donald Trump, who is sworn in as U.S. president in January 2025 for the second time, plans the largest deportation operation in American history and intends to use the Alien Enemies Act from 1798, a law that allows the deportation of undocumented people from enemy nations during a time of war, and played a role for the internment of Japanese during World War II.
Germany has gone from being a country of emigration to a country of refuge and still does not have an immigration policy worthy of the name.
Almost 8 decades after her escape, Ruth Sterngessen has returned to her home village Niederohmen one more time to present her childhood memories to a big audience. On a pole in front of the house of the Protestant congregation, the Reverend has hoisted the Spangled Banner. Introducing herself, Ruth speaks German, mixed with English and Hessian dialect.
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, ich spreche nicht mehr viel Deutsch. Aber es freut mich sehr viel zu sein in Niederohmen, to be here in Niederohmen heute. Ich habe gesehen viele Leute, das habe meine Familie gekannt. Und es ist gut for my heart,
yes. Warm applause fills the hall. These are Ruth's words. I don't speak German anymore, but I'm very happy to be in Niederohmen, to be here in Niederohmen again. I saw a lot of people who knew my family, and it's good for my heart, mein Herz, to be here. Ruth Sterngessen is building bridges between people of different age, descent, opinion, religion, or culture, and still hopes, as her father Josef Stern did, that mankind is able to learn from the past. There has been a rally for love in Livermore in the Tri-Valley in California, where she's living with her husband Sam Stone, family and friends. Ruth, a child survivor of the Holocaust, former refugee and accidental American, who has founded an interfaith group and encouraged people to vote and to stand up for democracy, was asked to hold one of the speeches.
I have the dubious distinction of entering the world scene the same year as Adolf Hitler. He became Chancellor of Germany, and I was born in a tiny German village. My parents and I lived in a little cluster of farmhouses. As a small child, I wandered from house to house, totally free. The front doors were open. I might help shell peas, sit next to a grandmother who was knitting, and have her tell me a story, or romp with the family dog. One day, the doors were closed. My mother told me it was because I was Jewish, and Hitler had issued an edict. Christians were not to socialize with the Jews. I was confused and sad. But not everyone was intimidated. Soon, the heavy winter snow started falling. One snowy evening, we heard a knock on the door. Our neighbor, Anna, stood there with her sled. Since the Nazis keep me from taking Ruthie sledding in the afternoon, let's go out now when no one is watching. For the next 2 years, we went sledding in the moonlight. One of the few happy memories of my childhood. Fast forward to today. Like Anna, we are not intimidated. In the Tri-Valley, we aren't shutting our doors on vulnerable people. We are having a rally to say we honor diversity and value us all. I'm happy to be a part of it.
Now we will listen to Henry Smolin, who was born in the United States in 1998, play Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 3, Opus 2. This piece was recorded when he was a teenager.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the podcast, Now We Go Overseas, a free production from the Historical Society, La Storia Bremen, with volunteers from the United States, written by and final technical editing by Monica Felsing, English version directed by Susan Eldridge.
Recordings by Susan Eldridge, Justus Rand, Monika Felsing, and some of the readers. Theme: We Go Overseas, intro and extra melody, Burkhard Bock, Bremen, and Monika Felsing, Bremen and Oberglehn, Germany. First narrator, Susan Eldridge, near Badenhausen, Connecticut, USA. Second narrator, Monika Felsing, Bremen, Germany. Timeline: Horst Rasch, Erika Thies and Hans Ganten, Worpswede, Reinhard Jung, Ritterhude, Peter Kühlborn, Oberramstadt, Christine Renken, Beruta Adolf, Jürgen Moser, Justus Rand, and Monika Felsing, Bremen, who also read the poem Heimat by Hilda Stern Cohen. Robin's Mall, California, USA. Herbert Sontheim, USA, recording from the 70s. Albert Stern, Joachim Hahn, webmaster of Alemannia Judaica, Germany. Ernst Lothar Stern, USA, recording from about 2017. Ruth Stern Gersten, Livermore, USA. Bulbous Song, Yellstrom, San Diego, violin, and Nikolai Muck, Frankfurt upon Main, guitar, in 2017 in the former synagogue of Oberglehn. Escape Here, Upper Hessian cover song of Donna Donna or Das Kälbel by Shlomo Sekunda, composed in 1940, sang by the Project Choir at the benefit concert for Reporters Without Borders at the Alsfelder Kulturtage in 2022 with Hans-Peter Klein, Bianca Harich, Arnulf Triebel, Helmut Mess, Elisabeth Wagner, Regina Weller, Peter Jerabeck, Claudia Munch, Monika Felsing, Anna Thum and Rebecca Bachmann. At the piano and leading the concert, Veronika Blömers. Sa kennst du mich, Upper Hessian cover song of Auld Lang Syne, written by Monika Felsing, sang by the audience in a singing workshop in the former synagogue of Oberglehn in 2019. Klezmer improvisation, Yellstrom, San Diego, USA, and Clive Ford, Edna Eversmeyer, Till Eversmeyer and David Hodgkinson of the klezmer group Kladatje, Ortrud Staude, Burkhard Bock of Paradogma, and Thomas Stapke at a klezmer workshop taught by Yellstrom in March 2019 in Bremen, Germany. Sabbath Song, Veronika Blömers in the Hohaus Museum Lauterbach, Upper Hesse in 2018 during the presentation of the audiobook Yiddish Life of La Storia. Beethoven's Piano Sonate No. 3, Opus 2, played by Henry Small, the grandson of Herbert Sontheim from Oberglehn.
Copyright in Connecticut, United States, and in Bremen, Germany, 2023 and 2024. The Historical Society La Storia wishes to thank every volunteer who participated in this transatlantic project about migration, as well as everyone who performed the research and published information from which this was written. Our podcast consists of 6 parts. The original version is in German. the German historian Monika Felsing used AI for initial translations of her manuscript from German to English, which was then revised with help from Susan Eldridge, née Badenhausen. The English and German parts of the podcast are online in the United States at badmorgen.wordpress.com. That's badmorgen.wordpress.com. In Germany, you can find them at monikafelsing.de. That's monikafelsing.de. The manuscripts and bibliography will be available at a later date. Please don't hesitate to contact us in Germany at mail@lastoria-bremen.de or in the United States at badmoregenealogy@gmail.com. Copyright, all rights reserved. Public performance only with permission from the Historical Society Lastoria, Bremen, Bremen, Germany, and Connecticut, USA, 2023 and 2024.